Here we go. Okay, Rebosa, this is very exciting, and I'm still getting used to this dynamic of people being off screen over here. All these lovely people here in person, as well as the people on the computer. So I'm going to try to direct my attention accordingly. Now, we today, God willing, are going to be finishing the second chapter of Makos. We're finishing, God willing, the second parak, unless some really crazy thing happens to us. That is the plan. Within the next 15 minutes or 20 minutes or so. So just hold on for that. Toby, welcome, please. Now, we are actually going to start with the bottom of Yud Beis Amud Beis, the bottom of 12b. Let me just move my computer over to make some room. And then we will proceed. You can see on Yud Gimel and Aleph on 13a, it says a nice Hadronach Elu Hein HaGolan. That's the conclusion of the chapter. And then we go forward. So, by the way, when we start chapter three, there's gonna be a load of new concepts. Like it's Yedios Klolios heaven right there, because basically at the beginning of chapter three, we're gonna list not every single thing that gives you Malchus, because that's much longer than our Mishnah, but we're gonna list a lot of sins that incur Malchus. It's gonna be a lot of fun. And there's gonna be a lot of concepts in there that might be new for some of us. So this is going to be a very educational evening, I would hope. Okay. Right, Erwin, I know you've been looking forward to this the whole time, right? You finally, right. Erwin's question is, okay, I've been learning Magus this whole time. Who do I get to whack? Right? That's been our question up until now.
What are the whips?
Right, where are the whips? Where are the whips? Today we have scotch. The next time, when we finish Makos, everyone gets an honorary whip. How about that? We'll talk about in the third chapter, actually, what the whips looked like, what they consisted of. So we're on the bottom of 12b we're going to start with. Perfect. Here we go. Let's start with the Mishnah. Kayotze bo, again, bottom of 12b. Bottom of Yud Beis Amud Beis. Kayotze bo, rotzeach shegola le'ir miklato, v'ratzu anshei ha'ir lechabdo, yomer lehem rotzeach ani. So let's say someone kills accidentally, b'shogeg, that's what we've been talking about. He goes to the Eir Mikla, and then he comes in, and everyone's like, oh, this guy was like one of the Gedolei Dor. He starts saying, Yamim, you guys know what I'm talking about, right? So in yeshiva culture, when a Gadol Hador, when a big rabbinic figure comes into the room, there's like a whole entire entourage, and like everyone's singing that song from Tehillim. Yamim, Yamim, Lef. Okay, God willing, one day we'll see it. You know, and then he says, you know, guys, you really shouldn't be singing for me. I accidentally killed somebody, so I shouldn't be honored. So, and then they say, Amrlo, Afal Pi Kein, even still, we want to honor you. You Kabbal man. And okay, you say, okay, look, you really want to honor me. I'm not gonna fight you. Why? Because Shnema Rezetz Varha, his obligation is to tell him not to honor him. If they insist, that's their problem, not his. What is this relevant for? Remember, during our those who were with us during our Monday night class, we were talking about excessive rabbinic honorifics, and we're talking about maybe how a rabbi is supposed to, you know, say, "Don't call me Hagon HaRav, HaMeforsam, HaEloi, and this and that," but rather, what you should do is, you know, just like call me either by rabbi or, you know, doesn't have to be anything too fancy. But let's say everyone insists nonetheless, and then okay, so where's this question come up? So actually, I was looking it up in the Talmud Yerushalmi. It takes this case and it actually applies it to, let's say we thought a Talmud Chacham, he knew two areas of Torah. He finished two Masechtas, but really, you know, let's say we thought he finished Makos and Gittin, but really he only learned Makos. He didn't get up to Gittin yet, whatever. You know, he's going out of order. So then the question is he obligated to correct everybody and say, look, I know some Torah, but I don't know as much Torah as you guys think I do. So you don't need to be singing when I come into the room. So is he obligated to tell him that? Well, there's a Gemara Maseches Chulin on Tzadi Dalid Amud Beis, which this comes up in a lot of Siyus, a very important Yisod, which was, I'm forgetting the names of the rabbis, but essentially they came to town and the other rabbi came out and he said, oh, you guys came to honor me. Thank you for coming to visit me. And they're all like, oh, we didn't actually come to visit him. It's like really awkward. So the Gemara says they don't have to tell him otherwise because he was deceiving himself. They didn't do anything to deceive him. He fooled himself. So since he fooled himself, it's not their problem. This comes up a lot. God willing, Yesterday, the new RGJ journals went to print, so my essay in there, it should be in there, on Onas Devarim, on political correctness, sensitivity, freedom of speech should be in there. And I make a whole argument based on this Gemara at the end about at what point is it considered me offending you versus you taking offense and causing the emotions to yourself. So anyway, I'll share that with you then. We did Onas Devarim together a while back, but you know, we always do Chazara. Okay, anyway, that's the first part of the Mishnah. And so Malim Hayuskar Levim Divri Rabbi Huda, right? Mayor Omer, we're turning the page. I'm not turning really, just going to the next one. Lo Hayu Malahan Skar. So we had a machlokus, right? Toby, last time you mentioned about Rikers, well, not Rikers, but jail in general. And I didn't realize this, but apparently sometimes they can actually make you pay for renting the space. For apparently it's like a hotel stay already. People pay to go to Alcatraz. So I guess, you know, you could pay for this also. So the question is it bad enough that I'm being sentenced to the Eir Miklat? But then on top of that, now I have to pay my jail fee while I'm in there, you know, I have to rent the space. So it's a machlokes. According to Rabbi Yehuda, you do pay rental space. According to Rabbi Meir, look, you're already being incarcerated, so to speak, in exile. So we're not gonna add insult to injury. And then it's the final point of the Mishnah. The Seifa is v'chozir l'sra shahayah b'direi meir. Now the question is, let's say this guy finally, the Kohen Gadol dies, and now I finally get to go free. Now the question is, if originally I was like the chief rabbi of a certain area, can I be reinstated into my position of glory? Or maybe, you know, look, I'm free now, but I still committed a terrible sin of killing somebody, so we're not going to reinstate me. So it's machlokus. Rabbi Meir says you do get to be reinstated. According to Rabbi Yehuda, lo hayachoser l'sra shahayaba, you cannot return back to the days of yore. There will still be an indelible change on your life. Okay, that's the end of the Mishnah. We learned the Mishnah last time. We reviewed it because, well, frankly, the Gemara comments on the Mishnah. So we need to remember that Mishnah. Your gear said, and law, not ba. Very interesting. You know, what's especially interesting? What do you guys have in the other Gemaras? Ba. You know, that's the funny thing. My Gemara comes with different hagos, emendations, and they'll give you alternative text. I don't have an alternative text here, so maybe it's a different manuscript. Very interesting. But either way, I don't know if it would significantly change the meaning from a halakhic standpoint. Inside as opposed to it. Interesting. Yeah. That's very fascinating. What kind of, is that a specific brand of Gemara? What do you got there? It's like your Hassan shots from Oh, wow. Okay. It's all right. You know, you got a special antique over there. Wow. Very good. Very good. All right. This is your 100th time through Makos. I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, a little bit less.
Okay, good to have you along the journey once again. Okay, so going forward, Lissa, you're welcome to join us. Let me. Okay, so going forward into the Gemara, Amar Rav Kahana, Machlokes B'Sheish. So here's the question. Remember when we started the second parak, we learned that there are two sets of Ari Miklat. There's the original six Ari Miklat, the original six cities when they came into the land. So there were six. There are three in Averly Yarden on the east side of the Jordan, and then three inside Eretz Yisrael proper. Now, there were another, I think Abaye pointed out, there are another 42 cities. So the Gemara is going to draw a distinction between the nature of the first six versus the other 42. And it is as follows. Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana says, Machlokes B'Sheish. Everyone agrees you have to pay rent in the other 42 cities. What's the dispute in the Mishnah pertain to? It pertains only to the original six. That's where there's ambiguity. Demar Savar Lechem L'Klita, Omar Savar Lechem L'Chol Tzarchechem. Because one opinion states that in the first original six cities, Lechem, when it says it should be for you, the city should be for you, it means strictly to protect you, but not for your other necessities. Whereas the opinion says you don't have to pay rent, says the word Lechem in the verse comes to teach me, Lechem Lechot Tzarchechem, this city is being established for you, for all of your needs for livelihood, which includes space to live. So then you don't need to pay rental space. Aval bar by Mishnayim, whereas the other 42 cities, Divrei HaKol Hayu Malahem Schar. According to everyone, it's not disputed. Everyone agrees unanimously that you need to pay rental space in the other 42. The original six, those were, I guess, more like the public housing ones, and the other 42 were like the upscale luxury ones, so you pay rental in those cities. I have no idea if that's actually the case, but stands to reason. Okay. Whereas, so this is interesting. We have a machlokis about the machlokis. There's a disputation here as to how to understand what the machlokis in our Mishnah pertains to. So one opinion we just saw said the machlokis about whether to pay rent or not pertains to the original six cities. But now we have another opinion that says this machlokis applies to the other 42 cities. So it's a machlokis about where we are applying the machlokis in the Mishnah. We follow? Good. So the second opinion is, Amar Le Rava, Havadai Lechem L'chotzer Chechem, Mashma. Certainly Lechem includes, rent includes all of your needs for livelihood when it comes to the first six cities. Elo Amar Rava, Machlokis Barabai Mishnayim. Where does this Machlokis apply? To the other, the additional 42 that they added on. Demar Savar Valeim Titnu. We take out those next two words. It doesn't really fit in so well. Valeim Titnu Liklita. One opinion says that these cities were given to you for what? For protection. Umar Savar Valeim Titnu Kihanach. That these other 42 cities were given to you like the original six cities. They're modeled after the first six. Mahanach Lechotzer Chechem, just as the first six cities not only protect me, but provide for me as well. So too, these also provide for me for all my needs. Al-Bashesh, whereas the original six cities, everyone agrees that when it comes to the original six cities, there you do not have to pay rent. So basically, if you want to get a more convenient location, right? Your friends and family are living somewhere else. So good, we have 42 other Ari Miklat. So you don't want to have to go to one of the original ones. You want to get the luxury condos in the special Ari Miklat. So okay, so then pay rent if you want to go there. If you want to go to the original Ari Miklat, then you do not need to pay rent according to that opinion. Okay. Rather straightforward, I believe, but let me pause. Clarification questions. Do we have any clarification questions? Okay, much simpler than the trees and the roots and where do we classify everything, right? A little bit more straightforward, Baruch Hashem. Okay, so now we're going to analyze the seifa of the Mishnah, the last dispute in the Mishnah. Chozer l'sora shahayaba. So we had a dispute. Once I'm free from the Ir Miklat, do I return back to my original stature of glory? Tana Rabbanan. Well, this, of course, as we learned, is subject to dispute. But now, how do we make a determination, right? You know, where are they coming up with this? So there's another place in the Torah that we have somebody who is, I guess, I wouldn't say incarcerated, but in this case, actually indentured for a certain amount of time. And then while they are indentured, they don't have all of the perks that they had when they were free. But when they go free, the question is, do they get to return back to their state of glory? And of course, we're talking about the Eved Ivri. We're talking about a Jewish person. They stole money from somebody. And they can't pay back. They don't have the means to pay back what they stole. So they are sold into indentured servitude in order to pay back. And now that they go free, the question is, do we treat them as being fully, rehabilitated? Do we treat them as being fully rehabilitated and then they can enter society as if nothing ever happened? Or do we still treat them as, look, we were letting you go free, but you can't necessarily vote in the elections, right? This is a conversation that happens in America today. When someone goes free from after they serve their sentence in prison, do we recognize it now as they did a full kapara, a full atonement, and now they get to participate as a regular upstanding member of society? Or it's like, look, we're not going to keep you incarcerated longer, but you've done something that is irreversible and will affect your status the rest of your life. This is a conversation that's had in America, and it's kind of like a conversation that you can see happening here in the Gemara, I believe, as well. So let's jump into it. Tana Rabbanan, v'shav el mishpachto, v'achuzes avos av yeshuv. It says that the Eved Ivri, when he goes free from his indentured servitude, he will return back to the to his family and to the holdings of his family. I'm curious how they what's the translation that Rabbi Arts uses? Who's like the holdings of their family? I'm curious the estate of their family. Estate. Okay. Okay. The estate of their family, but the general holdings of their family is what it refers to. So the mishpachto hu shav. Look, you get to go back to your family, you get to go back to live on the ranch with them, but you don't get to return back to that which your family achieved. You know, if you live in this, again, I don't know why it's a good thing, but you have like a dynastic family and they have certain honors because of what their family achieved, you don't get those associated honors. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. However, Rabbi Meir argues, Avu Shalom Ashezik Avosav, he gets to obtain that which his ancestors have gotten from him. Lachuzes Avosav, Kit Avosav, just like his, when we say he returns to his fathers, just like his fathers, the same stature. And then the Brisa says that the same way we have this dispute when it comes to an Eved Ivri, the same dispute applies here in our case with a Rotsak, with someone who killed inadvertently. The Chaim Begola, same thing when someone goes into Gos. Shomer, Yashuv, because when it says it didn't have to say in the verse Yashuv went for the Eved Ivri. It could have said just Shav, Shin Beis. Why'd have to use a longer word Yashuv? So Yashuv Lerabos Etzerotseah, the longer word, the superfluous length of that word is in the Torah to include an extra halacha, which is that of the Rotseach. The same way we have this dispute when it comes to Eved Ivri, does he get to fully return back into society? It's the same dispute about the Rotseach who inadvertently kills. Shkoyach, there's an extra word, Yashuv, you know? I can include anything in there. You know, why the Rotseach? Why would I connect the Eved Ivri and the Rotseach? What does one have to do with the other? Like, I hear thematically how they're similar, but I need something a little bit stronger, you know, because if I just have an extra word for Eved Ivri, I don't know, let me include something of Meister Shani in there. You know, why should I include Rotseach in there? So my v'chem begola. So first of all, where do we see that the same machlok applies when it comes to Rotseach? Kedetanya. Yashuv ha-Rotseach la-Eretz Achuzah. So that it says in the verse that the Rotseach will return back to his original family holdings. La-Eretz Achuzah su-Shav, he returns back to the land, right, to the estate of his family. The Eino Shav Lamasheh Ziku Avosav, he doesn't return back to that which they have attained, what they acquired, Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. That's Rabbi Yehuda's Shita. Rabbi Meir Omer, Afu Shav Lamasheh Ziku Avosav, the same dispute again, that Rabbi Meir says he returns even back to his original state. Now, what is the basis to connect Rotseach and a Jewish person who is in indentured servitude? The connection is from a Gezerah Shava. What's Gezerah Shava? Gezerah Shava, again, is when you have two words in different topics. So then having those two extra words that are the same word or the same root in two different areas of the Torah teaches us that we're supposed to connect some of their laws. So Gamar, it's not Seva, by the way, Shiva, Shiva, Mehasim. It uses the language of Yashuv, of returning, in the context of the Eved Ivri and the context of the Rotseach. And that's how we know that there are supposed to be analogous halachos between those two areas of the Torah. Hadron Alach Eluhein Hagolin. And that brings us to the end of the second parak of Makos. Yashir Kayach, everyone. All right. We'll bring out the scotch at the end, though, right? Is that the plan?
No, cool.
I just feel bad to leave everyone here on the computer. Oh, say my Zadie has his Jim Crow, not Jim Crow, Old Crow. You have your bourbon over there. I thought it said Jim Crow. Yes. I was like, wow, that's like quite a bourbon you got there. Okay, that's what confused me. Right, I put both of those together. Not a good conclusion. Okay. So, all right. So let's go forward. I just wanted to take a photo for promotional purposes. We have more people here now. If you want to join the sport? You're welcome. Okay. You don't have to if you don't want to. We have more face on here because as I was telling everyone beforehand, before your start, some of you weren't on yet, that we do such a good job promoting the social programs at the shul that I think it's important, especially that we promote with photos also the learning programs. What? And Toby couldn't agree with me more. Okay, so this goes on social media. So if for some reason you don't want your face on there, you can turn off your video, but I encourage you to keep it on. So that way we can all just celebrate together. Here we are. Beautiful. Back to Torah. Okay. That was our Urn Pitel Torah that we had for finishing the Torah. Station identification. Oh, yeah. All right. Beautiful.
I have a question.
Oh, station identification.
Oh, yeah. Station.
Oh, okay. Yes, Sadie.
I have a question.
Absolutely.
If our exile has to pay rent, is he permitted to hold a job so that he can pay rent? Plus, he's got other living expenses like food and clothing.
Right. So I don't think once you enter the Ir Miklat, it becomes, like a kibbutz. You know, it doesn't become like a socialist sanctuary, so to speak. I'm not getting political on it, but what I mean is I don't see a reason why he can't still work and earn his own money to pay the rent, especially if that's the expectation. Because, you know, especially according to the opinion, you need to pay rent within the original six cities. And let's say you just don't have the finances, where are we putting you? Right? We're going to send you to Ir Miklat and put you on the street? I would hope not. So I don't see a reason why he wouldn't be able to work in the Ir Miklat. You know, he's not just supposed to sit around and wallow all day. He's supposed to be a productive member of society to the best that he can within that context. So it would stand to reason that he's able to work inside the Ir Miklat. Okay. Any other questions on the second perek before we go on to the third perek? Yes, Judge.
Is there anything that identifies the person who's the Motzeach in the city? Not anybody in the city.
Interesting. So you see, you know, what Judd's pointing out is in other areas of halacha, sometimes we wear clothing which identifies us. Meaning, nowadays we have a beautiful mikveh at the shul, and the laws of mikveh generally is when a woman goes out to mikveh on mikveh night, it's a very private affair. You know, we try not to be around when women are going to mikveh. We try to give a lot of privacy. It's based on the Rama and the Shulchan Aruch. So the funny thing is, back in the day, you see, there's two components to the laws of Nida. People learn Maseches Nida, and they're like, oh, I'm going to learn all the rules of Taharas HaMishpacha and family purity. A lot of it has to do with, like, Tumah and Tahara. Because back in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, there was, one part of being Nida was the relationship between a man and his wife. But another huge part was her vis-a-vis society that people had to watch out. When she's a Nida, and we're going to be talking about Nida in the next Mishnah, she's also Tameh. And she can transmit tumah to things. So actually, they would wear big day nida. They'd wear clothing that was, I don't know exactly what it looked like per se, but it basically was the clothing that a woman wore when she was a nida. And part of the purpose of that clothing was to show people, watch out, I'm tumah. So, you know, I think to your point, we do see in halacha sometimes that there is this notion of wearing clothing to show, I don't think they're, you know. What if they were men and were tummy? Maybe they did also. I'm not sure. Mary, what do you think? You usually got something? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe men probably just didn't have as big of a wardrobe back then, so I'm not sure. I don't know. It's a good question, Toby. It's Archean. Okay. Any other questions, thoughts, haros on the second chapter? I know it's very hard. Kushal, I prayed awesome. It's hard to part. But this is the last chapter of Makos, and it also comprises half of Makos. So in addition to finishing the second chapter, we also are roughly halfway through the entire Masechta. So we've been at this for about half a year now. This is, I mean, again, I'm just reflecting. We started in January. You know, this is going really strong. I just want to give a huge Yashar Koach to everyone for staying committed, staying on board, and for this huge achievement. I hope in another half year from now, God willing, we will be able to make a siyum on the entire Masechta Be'ezus Hashem Yisbarach. Okay, starting the third chapter of Makos. As I said, a lot of Yedios Klalios, learning a lot of stuff here. What we are going to do now is the Mishnah is going to list not every instance that someone could get Malkus, could get lashes, but a lot of them. And the general breakdown of the Mishnah is we're first going to list sins which not only give you Malkus, but incur caris, incur divine excision. So I know we got Toby and Marina and Phyllis who are with us for Shara Gemula. We talked a little bit about caris. What is divine excision? So there's like, I think, at least four different opinions. Either it's a more extreme form, Misa B'dei Shemayim. It's just you die at a very advanced age. Your children, you don't have children. It's you get cut off from the world to come to a certain degree. So all sorts of different interpretations of what caris is. There's different kinds of caris. So basically, without jumping into all of the theological ideas, you're getting caris and you're getting malchus. So you're hit with the double whammy. Whereas the final part, the middle part of the Mishnah, will list just sins that give us malchus alone. And the final part of the Mishnah is just gets into a separate machlokas. So a very important concept to remember that we're going to deal with in this parak is called kimlei b'derab aminei. Kimlei b'derab aminei means, and we talked about this at the beginning of the Sefta, is if I incur two punishments, Basin only whacks me with the harder one. So for instance, if they occur simultaneously, right, exactly. So I could get two malchus at the same time. I could have to pay a lot of money at the same time, but I'm not, for instance, going to be put to death and given malchus before I'm put to death. There is a havamina in the chapter here. We'll see that maybe it's a misa arichta, that we start off with the malchus and then we end off by killing you. But I believe it's rejected as far as I recall. Okay, so let's jump into the third parak. Here we go. The Elu Hein Alokin, right? So before we were talking about Elu Hein HaGolan, who goes to Gullus. Now we're talking about who gets Malchus, which, you know, you would think this is something we would deal with a little bit earlier on. So I appreciate all of our patience. Haba Alchot. So first we're going to talk about sexual sins. Haba Alchoso, someone who comes upon his sister. Vachos Aviv, the sister of his father. Vachos Imo, the sister of his mother. Vachos Ishto, the sister of his wife. Va'eshes Achiv, the sister of his brother. Va'eshes Achi Aviv, the wife of your father's brother. Va'alha Nida, so Nida incurs that as well. Amana L'Kohen Gadol, a widow to the high priest. Grusha V'Chalutza L'Kohen Hedyo, a divorcee or a woman who got Chalitza to a regular Kohen. So a woman who got either divorced or again, so Yibam is the process where, just very briefly, if a man dies and doesn't leave any children in this world, then his brother has a mitzvah to marry his former wife who he left in this world to continue that line. We talked about the Chumashir a while back, I remember, on Sunday mornings. So if this woman, but if he doesn't want to marry her, which is understandable, it's like, be a little of an awkward situation. So for whatever reason he doesn't want to marry her. He does chalitza, which is it's like a pseudo divorce because they were never fully married. So it's a pseudo divorce of sorts. So therefore the rabbi said, since chalitza is very similar to divorce, also a chalitza shouldn't marry even a regular kohen. That's halacha lemaisa today also. Mamzeres unesina liyisrael, a mamzeres or nesina, people who have a very, very questionable conversion Jewish status. They're in a separate category of their own. Mamzeres and nesina liyisrael, bas yisrael lenasin ulamamzer. So either a female mamzer and nesina to a male Jew, or a female Jew to a male nesin or mamzer, someone who is born. Now, I know we translate sometimes as out of wedlock. That's inaccurate because we say, you know, wedlock in English can mean a man and woman before they're married had a kid. And we say the child's born out of wedlock and is a bastard, but that's not true in halacha. Halacha, it's a much more limited term. So a mamzer, for instance, from an adulterous union, yes. I mean, there's a whole machlokas in the Gemara, what kind of unions create mamzerus. So I believe it needs to be something that's actually punishable by death. If it's not punishable by death, then it does not create a mamzer, as far as I recollect.
For that reason, Arshkol doesn't try to, it's one of the words that Arshkol does not try to translate.
Ah, very good.
It says mamzera, so they don't try to translate it because it's not going to accurately.
Also because Arshkol has also a yeshivish audience, which wouldn't like the word bastard. It's because it's like a...
Maybe.
But I do agree, right. Arshkol doesn't translate the word mamzer because to translate it to English doesn't do it justice. It would confuse us more than it would help us. So yes, Henry, that's a good point. Yeah. I believe Oh, you're saying because it's his sin, not her sin. Oh, so she might not be getting it, actually. I'm not sure. I don't think she is because it's not her sin. It's his sin. Yeah, I think you'd be right. I think that's correct. I have to verify it, but I think your intuition's correct, Toby.
But with all these other ones, even though it's sort of the way they worded.
Like on the Ariok, on the...
Right, so it depends what kind we're talking about over here. I think the... Right, so I think both of them are punishable. I think both of them are punishable for it.
And it's interesting because it doesn't say they.
Yeah, in Kitetse, the different cases that the Torah gives, if she consented, then she's equally liable.
Right, right. Of course, if it's an ones, if it was done against her will, it was coerced, then, you know, ones rachmana patri. You're an ones. Right. You're right.
That's why they assume if it's in the city, then she should have screened for help or whatever.
Right, right. Right.
And then if it was out in the field,
we assume nobody hears her.
But the assumption is she did protest.
Right, and we just didn't hear.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So she would be in that case.
Very good. You know, we actually, when I first came here and I started giving the Sunday morning chumash here, that was our first section of Torah we did together on Kiseitze. Mm-hmm. And now we're in Vayelech. So, okay, we're doing well. There's like Haba Yevimto. You know, you see, I don't think Haba implies rape per se.
This is just an out here as well. Although the Mishnah mentions only the male partner incurs punishment, the same punishment applies to the female partner's ambition.
Right. I think generally we speak from the masculine standpoint. Whether you like it or not, that's just how the Torah and rabbinic literature is written. So that's why.
Yeah. Footnote two.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I don't think this is, you know, it doesn't mention ones is the legal term for rape in halacha. So there's no mentioning of ones here. As Henry points out in the Pesukim in Kiseitze, it distinguishes between a woman who consents versus a woman who does not consent. So if you don't consent, you know, you're not being punished for that. Bia just means sexual relations in general. Bia doesn't mean, because we say kiddushin, kesef shtar bia. So I hope it's not through rape, right? So when someone is betrothed a woman, bia is one of the ways we do it. They're abanan, they give you malchus if you do it that way. Right, exactly. Otherwise, it's no kiddushin. Kiddushin, exactly. So as Toby points out from your kiddushin days that you're learning kiddushin with Rabbi Bernstein, right? So kiddushin needs to be consensual because she is being makna. She's giving herself over to her groom, her husband to be. So by its very nature, it has to be consensual. Okay. So let's just get to the end of that line. So very interesting point that we'll elaborate on later. So Amana Ugrusha, let's say she was widowed and then she got remarried and she was divorced and then she gets married to the Kohen Gadol. Chayavin Aleha Mishim Shnei Shemos. Then he gets hit with a double whammy because he violated two things at the same time. We're eventually going to get to a case in the Gemara where, you know, you get like seven or eight, I forgot exactly. Like you get like a million punches. Yeah, Henry, you know what I'm talking about, right? You're like, you're going Shemitah year. Yeah, we'll get to it. It's a good one. We got Rishia Bar Rishia coming up, which is going to be, that's an interesting one. Okay. So, and whereas a grusha v'chalutza inu chayav el mishum achas b'vad. Whereas, let's say a woman was divorced and she was a chalutza, she got chalitza, not ibam. There, however, you only has one shame. It has only one status of iser, of prohibition that you violated. Why? Because chalitza is a pseudo-divorce. So she already has a status of being a grusha. The chalitza is subsumed within the status of being a grusha. Whereas a widow and a divorcee are two different statuses, so you're punished twice for it. That's one reason. The other reason that the Mefarshim point out is that a chalutza being prohibited to a kohen is only a rabbinical prohibition. It was added on. You know, like we added on, just like we don't want you to mix meat and milk together, you don't mix chicken and milk together also, because it's similar. So don't, you know, mix You know, we don't want you to like marry a chalutza because very similar to a grusha. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So it's not from the same person. She went through two marriages. One ended in divorce. One ended in chalitza. The first one, yes.
Right.
The first one is almano grusha, a widow and a grusha. So the first one married, she was widowed from. The second one, she was divorced from. And now she's married to the third guy who's a kohen. That'd be the most simple scenario for that to happen.
I thought these are two totally separate cases.
Almana grusha would be a woman who is both an almana and a grusha, and that's why you get hit with a double whammy.
Right. But then the bottom one, divorcing is also a kohen.
Yeah. So she has both statuses. You have a woman who went through a divorce and went through chalitza, but you know, you would think that right. So marriage number one ended in divorce. Marriage number two, her husband died. It's only one because chalitza is rabbinical or because it's subsumed within gerushin in general. Okay, that's section number one, the Mishnah. We are at 7:53. Okay, we got some ground to cover at both sides. So let's go through and then try to save all our questions on the Mishnah for the end if possible. Hatame sha'achal es ha'kodesh. So now we're moving on from sexual prohibitions to prohibitions that have to do with general eating prohibitions. Hatame sha'achal es ha'kodesh. Let's say you're tame and you ate something that is consecrated, that's holy. That's a better translation. Ba'ba al mikdash tamei, or you enter into the base of mikdash while you are tamei. We're just talking about this in the Mishnah Yoma class today. Very important that the kohen has to go immerse himself in mikvah before he goes into the base of mikdash, because you go to the base of mikdash when you're tamei, you get malchus and kares. Ba'ochel chelev, that's not chalav, it's chelev. Bidam, you eat prohibited fats, you eat blood. Ve'nosar upigel, so here's some new concepts. Nosar is, let's say I have to eat a karban within 2 days, and I fail to eat, I think, a shlamim, right? Shlamim is 2 days. So I forget and I neglect to eat that in 2 days, then I eat it on the third day, then that is punishable. Similarly, upigal, what's pigal? Pigal is the kohen when he's going through the ritual of slaughtering the animal or carrying the blood at certain points during that procedure. If he has kavana, he has the intent to eat it in its wrong time, he deliberately doesn't want to eat it during its prescribed time, that would invalidate the carbon as well. Utame, and then also if you have something that was kodesh and became tame and you eat it, so that also is problematic. Vashoche umal bechutz, if you slaughter an animal and you bring it up on the mizbeach outside of the temple. By the way, right? So you ever wonder, why do we go so crazy about not eating chametz on Pesach? Why are we so careful about it? Well, in addition to other prohibitions in the Torah, which is a general lav, again, general averus, we don't like to do either, this has an additional level of kares, that you get divine excision for it. So therefore, this gives us a little bit more understanding of why we're so careful when it comes to chametz. Someone who eats or performs one of the 39 malachos on Yom Kippur. Here's another interesting one. Let's say I concoct the oil. Is that the term they use?
No,
concoct?
That's a good one.
Concoct someone? I'm curious how they translate mefatim.
Compound
or concoct. So I concoct the oils, or if I'm a mefatim, or I concoct, I create the incenses that were exact same incenses that were used in the temple, or basach b'shemen hamishka, if I anoint myself with the original anointing oil. Now, where does the original anointing oil come from? You look in Rashi, it says we had an original oil that was given to us by Moshe Rabbeinu. Remember, we talked about there was in the previous parak, there were kohanim who got the shemen hamishka, then there were kohanim who didn't get shemen hamishka. Like, big deal, just, you know, get some virgin olive oil from Stop and Shop and use that. So the difference is we had a special oil that was given to us by Moshe Rabbeinu. It became lost. So that's what we're talking about. If you try to replicate that oil, sorry, not if you're recognized, that oil is easily replicable. But if you use that oil somehow, you know, archaeologists dig it up today and they miraculously find what they believe is that oil, then you would violate a prohibition and curse Malchus and Kares by anointing yourself with that oil. Which is, I always love, like, you know, some of the things in Israel when you go for archaeology. I remember when I was in Shalavim, we went to Beit El. And in Beit El, there was like this tour guide on Shabbos who showed us around. And he's like, and this is the rock that Yaakov Avinu slept on. And I'm like, come on, man. Like, I don't care how good of an archaeologist you are. You did not identify the precise rock that Yaakov Avinu was on. Okay, I don't believe it. Anyway, so that's like, so I bet you someone's going to find like a jar of oil one day. It's like, while they're excavating something in Israel, and they're like, this is the exact oil that Moshe Rabbeinu used. Okay, maybe. Who knows? Or just someone else lived back then. Right. So that's what I was curious about, because as Toby points out, there's a Teres Kohanim, which is an organization that tries to replicate things from the temple to get ready for the Messiah. So the question is, do they do this? I would hope they don't, because it's prohibited, but it'd be very interesting. I was wondering this when I was learning it also. It's a good point, Toby. All right, that's a good question. But okay, let's get to the end of
that, Moshe, as preparing for, you're learning how to put it together. You're creating the knowledge, the formula. And so preparation for a future mitzvah isn't like you're doing the mitzvah now.
Right. So you're saying maybe if we're preparing it, but we're not planning on using it. You see, the thing is, it doesn't say using here. You know, Hasak B'Shem and Amishka is the issue of using the oil. But here, just putting it together is problematic. So you're right, you know, but what are we supposed to do? Like, let's say Mashiach, you know, just comes the next day and we're not prepared to do services in the temple. I mean, we're given the recipes, so I'm sure someone who's an apothecary can figure that one out. No one goes by apothecary today. Some pharmacists will figure it out for us.
Ask your brother about apothecary.
I'll ask my brother. My brother's in his rotations for pharmacy right now. So can I get him? Get Matthew Bernstein on it. All right. So, okay, let's go forward. Kama Yocha. We didn't get to there. Good. So now we're going to list a few things that you only get Malchus for, but you do not get Kares. Bochon the Velos Utrefos. No. So these above ones were Kares and Malchus, but they're not of a sexual nature. So that's the distinction between them in the first section. Yeah. These ones are only Malchus, I believe. But there was one exception thrown in there somewhere, actually. But I'm forgetting what it is at the moment. Okay, but ochon the velos utrefos. So there's different ways an animal can get invalidated. Either you didn't slaughter it properly, or you slaughtered it properly, but you found out that was a trefa, it had a hole in its lung, it was going to die within a year. And then, as Marissa always likes when I read, she thought I made this up. She thought it was like Yiddish, shkatzim v'ramasim, the creepy coli things, as we call them. I think one supposedly shkatzim sexually reproduces, and ramasim, they believe spontaneously generated back then. But you know, in the yeshivish world, it's a slur. He calls someone a shkatz. It's a slur. So shkatzim v'ramasim. Achal tevel. So what's tevel? Tevel is food that you do not take trumas and maisers off from, trumas or maisers off from. Or let's say you have Maaser Rishon now, but you didn't take yet Truma off from it, and you're a lady who wants to eat the Maaser Rishon. Maaser Sheni, our good friend Maaser Sheni that we learned about last time, we know all about Maaser Sheni now. So Maaser Sheni is supposed to bring to your Shalayim, the Hekdish, or consecrated food. Shlo Niftu, that was not redeemed yet, and regarding the Maaser Sheni, if I didn't eat it in Yerushalayim, then that also incurs Malchus. So all the different kinds of ways to incur Malchus. Rashi points out, I'm not going to go through it inside, and there are other Rishonim that elaborate further. Rashi says that this is a case of the ton of the Shear, that we gave a partial list, but we did not. You think there's a lot of Averos? There's even more Averos that give you Malchus that are not on this list, the Rishonim point out. So why did we specify these ones? So you go through Rashi. Rashi points out that one chiddush I want to teach us was that you could get Malchus and Kares at the same time. And then another chiddush for Grusha, for a Amana and Grusha, want to teach me that I get two punishments at the same time. And then another chiddush was that when it came to Truma, it wasn't mentioned explicitly in the Torah, the punishment. So therefore, it included that in the Mishnah. And then also, we just learned Mechusar Yipidiyah, things that were not yet redeemed. We weren't poed to them. That also. So basically, the Rishonim go through and they try to figure out every part of the Mishnah. Why do we have to include these specific things that incur Malkus, whereas we did not include other kinds of Lavin that would incur that? Okay, something to go through. I think the Rifta goes in more depth. Okay, final part of the Mishnah. Kama Yochel Min HaTevel V'Yichayet. How much of this Tevel do you have to eat in order for you to incur Malkus? So Machlokes, Rabbi Shimon Omer Kolshu, even just a little bit, that is going to give you a good whopping 39 lashes. V'Chachamim Omerim Kizayis, whereas the Rabbanan say, no, like Moshe Yirmei in the Torah, we usually go with a Kizayis, an olive's amount. So, you know, and if they're going by today's standards of what we call a kezias, then it's a lot, right? You have to eat a whole suda, according to some books, you know, and they say how big a kezias is. So, it is, but I'm kind of, I'm making a little bit of a joke that some people believe that the olive grew significantly over time, or the Shana Priyasa. Yeah, exactly. The Shana Priyasa, something like that. So, and Shana Habrios, that nature changed over time. So it's some say that it's a hard argument to make because you need scientific proof for that. Okay, now the Rabbana responds. Amar lehen, sorry, Rabbi Shimon responds. Amar lehen, Rabbi Shimon, atem odeli ba'ochel lemala kol shushu chayev. If you agree, you guys agree that if I take an ant is smaller than an ant, and I eat an entire ant, I would be chayv for eating that ant. So then why over here, when it comes to Tevel, food I didn't take Maisers and Trumos off from yet, why do I have to eat up to Gezias, even a little bit? Even something as small as an ant should make me chayv. So Amar lo, Mnei Shehi Kabir Yasa, because it's an entire entity, an entire creation. Now that's why it's very important. You know, Nat Sandberg is courageously goes to Navratna multiple times a week, and he checks the vegetables for us. You would say, oh, who cares? It's like a little bug over there. It gets into food, right? Apparently, a lot of people who aren't Jewish don't care about those little bugs because they don't have non-Jewish mashkichim checking for bugs. You know, like, okay, it's fine, whatever. So because something that has an entire birya, even if it's under a kezias, but it's an entire birya, that birya will be problematic from a kosher standpoint. So they said, oh, that's the difference. Here we're talking about an entire creation. Amar lehen, Rabbi Shimon said back, he retorted, a piece of wheat, a kernel of wheat is also an entire birya. So if you're going to tell me that an ant is problematic, what's the difference between an ant versus a kernel? So that's where the Mishnah leaves off. Now, we're going to have to wait a while to elaborate on the last part, the seifa of the Mishnah, but we're going to elaborate on the resha of the Mishnah first. We want to identify who is the opinion, who's the Tana of our Mishnah. Now, what's interesting the Gemara points out is that we listed averos that incur malchus and incur kares. However, we did include cases where you incur malchus and incur mises beisdin, capital punishment. Why don't we include that? It must be that if you get capital punishment, you don't also get malchus. So the Gemara is going to jump into a three-way machlokus momentarily regarding whether that's true. So the Gemara makes an inference from our Mishnah. Chayve krisus katani, chayve mises based on lo katani. I only see sins that incur kares in the Mishnah. I do not see sins that incur capital punishment. Why is that? Oh, matzisa money, because who does our Mishnah go according to? Rabbi Akiva, it goes according to Rabbi Akiva. The Tanya, as we taught in the Braisa, eche chayve krisus veche chayve mises based in, turning the page, you come on the base. Yeshu mechal malkus arboim divi Rabbi Shmuel. Opinion number one, three-way machlokes. Opinion number one in the Braisa says that even if you get mises beisdin, you're getting capital punishment, you also get malchus. So first we give you 39 lashes, and we're like, shkoyach, now we put you to death. What a lovely day for you. Nope. So that's opinion number one. We do not hold like that. Whereas the middle opinion, Rabbi Akiva, is the Tana of our Mishnah. Rabbi Akiva Omer, and this is like a very interesting idea. You know, another time we could elaborate on this. Chayve krisus, Rekiva Mary, Chayve krisus yeshon bechlam malchus arbaim, shemasu tshuva beisin shamam mochlenahen. So why, what's interesting, kares and you know, death by God versus death by beisin? Well, death by God, if I do tshuva at some point, if I repent, Hashem can forgive me for my sins, and I'll no longer incur kares. So since it's not a sure thing that I'm getting charis, we can't absolve you from malchus because it's not a sure thing that you're going to get charis. Whereas chayvi misis basin in a bechal malchus arba'im shemaser tshuva in basis shemata mochlehen. Whereas basin doesn't have the power to make these kind of calculations to say, you know what, I can see you're very remorseful. I can see that you attend all the shiurim during the week. Now you do this and that, you know, tzedakah, whatever it might be. So you know what, we're not going to give you misis basin. Basin doesn't have the prerogative to do that. So since we know it's a sure thing you're going to be put to death by Basin, therefore you can't get Malchus also because of our principle of Kimle B'Durabamine, that Basin can only give you one punishment, you can't get two. So that's Rabbi Akiva's opinion, which fits our Mishnah, which says you get Kares, but you do not get, you get Kares and Malchus, but you do not get capital punishment and Malchus. And then there is a third opinion, which also does not accord with our Mishnah, the other extreme. Rabbi Yitzhak Omer, Chayvei Krisus Bechlal Hayu. There's a general principle when it comes to getting Kares, that you only get Kares and you don't get anything else. You don't get Malchus in addition to it. Why? How do we know this? Olama Yatzas Kares Ba'achoso. Because when you look later on, in Sefer Vayikra, when it comes back to the Arias, it talks about having incest with one sister, it specifies that she gets kares. Why do we specify kares there? To teach us that when it comes to all of these sexual sins that occur kares, la dunu be kares velo be malchus, you only get kares, you don't get malchus. So what comes out is we have three opinions over here. Let's review. We have one extreme, which is Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael says you could get Kares and Malchus, you could get Misa and Malchus. We give you all the good stuff. You get everything, right? We're very inclusive of all the Misas, all the different kinds of punishments. Whereas on the opposite extreme, we have Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak says that when you get Kares, you only get Kares, you don't get Malchus. And in the middle, we have Rabbi Akiva, which is a town of our Mishnah, it seems, that says that you get Kares and Malchus because Kares is forgivable, whereas you do not get capital punishment. You don't get Mises based in and Malchus because we know you're getting Mises based in. Therefore, we don't give you Malchus because we only give you the harsher punishment. So that brings us to the end of our piece of Gemara today. I want to actually just quickly share an idea from Rav Zilberstein, which I think is really fascinating. And then if we have time, I'll stay on for questions, but Mincha is 8:15. So time is of the essence. Okay, here's a quickie from Zilberstein. What was that? We need our time, that's right. So you know what? How about this? I will leave you with the question. I will leave you with the question and we'll start with the answer next time. How does that sound? That sound fair? Here is a riddle that he asks. Chida, must I korsh on the Baal Chos of Noah Mamzer? What is a case where someone has incest with their sister, and has a mamzer from that union? Then achar kach no demashu. Then something new that they didn't know beforehand enters the equation. That's the blank. We don't know what that is. Or zos ein hayel mamzer kosher lavo legal mashu hamashu. So now and so. Oh, sorry, ma'ala mashu. So what is this new piece of information that the child would have been a mamzer before, but had now that I have this new piece of information added in, the child is no longer a mamzer? And don't tell me that they find out that they're not brothers and sisters. It's not as obvious as that. So I'll leave you with that question. What's a question where someone, we think they're a mamzer, we learned something new, some piece of data that we didn't have with us beforehand, they're still brothers and sisters, don't go cheap, and then we find out that the child's not a mamzer anymore? I leave you with that question to ponder as a cliffhanger for next week. But we have only 4 minutes to mincha, and we have a few shots of scotch to drink. So if you have some at your home, you've earned it. Don't go driving afterwards. Enjoy your scotch. Hadron Olach. You walked your toe. So Hadron Olach, everyone, of finishing the second parak. We will conclude here, and L'chaim.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you. Okay.